Welcome to the Runners Connect Run to the Top podcast, where it's all about learning from the best and most inspiring minds in the sport. So together, we can train a smarter, healthier, and faster running community. Now, here's your host, Tina Muir.
All right. Well, as you can tell from my distinctly American accent, I am not your usual host. My name is Sarah Crouch. I'm a professional marathoner with a personal best of 2:32, and I train in Kentucky, about an hour east of where your usual host lives and trains. So today, for this special Christmas episode, we're going to turn the tables a bit, and I'm going to be interviewing your usual host, Tina Muir, about her recent race at the California International Marathon, among other things. We will have our usual episode coming out on Wednesday the 28th, this time featuring Olympian and all-around great guy Jared Ward. But for this episode, I'm especially looking forward to it because my educational background is in sports psychology, so I'm also looking forward to breaking down Tina's psyche until she no longer knows who she is. So let's get started.
Well, firstly, I'm pretty excited about this, although maybe a little bit scared, because I actually don't know half of the things Sarah's going to ask me. So who knows what she's going to come up with, and so I apologize, as I am an emotional person, to anyone listening. If I end up crying, there's a good chance of that happening, because I'm a bit of a wimp. But
I now have a goal for this podcast, to make you cry. So.
Thanks.
All right, well, we'll start easy. I do want you to just recap. I've definitely heard your recap, but I know your listeners have not heard you talk yet about the California International Marathon. And for you, this was marathon number 5, and your time of 2:36:37, is that correct?
39.
2:36:39. That was a PR by almost exactly a minute, and it was faster than you ran at the London Marathon earlier this year. So a unique stat about your marathon career, and one that I'm very jealous of, is that each of your marathons have been faster than the last one. So where does the CIM experience as a whole rank among the other marathons that you've run?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because part of me is a little bit like, I don't know, because I have progressed each of my marathons, I ran 4 minutes faster than the last. So I feel like I kind of almost got a little bit spoiled, as if I kind of expected I could go on like that forever, which is obviously completely unrealistic because there was going to be a limit. But I kind of got in this mindset of every time I was going to knock 4 minutes off. So when it's funny now looking at this being like it was only a minute, which is a long way in a marathon, a lot of time, but I kind of had got so accustomed to just like shaving 4 minutes off at a time that it was hard to process at first. But I will say the more time I have to reflect on it, the more I do feel proud and I do feel excited about it. And like you mentioned, it is still a progression. It is something that, you know, I am making steps forward and, you know, it leaves me hungry for more, which I don't know is, sometimes I wonder if that is a good thing or if we ever are truly happy with what we've done. That makes me wonder if, you know, years ago this would have been a dream time and whether I ever will actually get to the point to where I'm truly happy. And you and I have actually talked about this a lot before, about whether, you know, Sarah's on the quest to break 2:30 and has a marathon up and coming. But then if you break 2:30, will you then be on the quest for 2:28? So it kind of makes me think about that. But overall, yeah, CIM was a great experience, one I would definitely recommend for people. But the biggest lesson to me was to make sure you study your course elevation guide correctly. It wasn't like it was, you know, giant hills, but just for me, I don't think I was prepared mentally or physically for it. That probably hindered me a little bit more than I should have, even though it wasn't their fault, it was my fault. So.
Right. And breaking that time off by 1 minute, do you think that will change how you go into marathons in the future? Like, will you expect those big jumps or are you now, will you settle for smaller incremental personal bests?
I think I would settle for smaller. I mean, I think I'm realizing that as I go up, you got to even be happy with just a few seconds. And I know how close you've been to even just PRing by a few seconds and you would have been so happy with that. So I think I'm learning that, you know, thank you to a lot of you guys who are listening, who have reminded me that a PR is still a PR, still the fastest you've ever gone. And actually you, Sarah, were the ones who text me, the first person to text me after the race saying this was my first sub 6 minute per mile marathon. So that in itself is a big barrier that I broke through. So yeah, I think it has somewhat changed the way I look at it.
Right, right. And what about the just the energy of the race itself? And it's definitely the highest you place, unless I'm wrong about this, I believe it's the highest you place in any marathon. You were 5th overall woman, is that correct?
Yeah, I was fifth woman. I mean, technically I was second in the championship second section at London, but, you know, that's obviously behind all the other elites who are set off separately, and you never really know. So, yeah, I think overall this is the highest I've placed in a race. And you know, it wasn't like it was a weak field. I mean, Steph Bruce is, you know, incredible runner herself, and you know, we had a good chunk of us elite runners there, so it was, I'm happy with that fifth place.
Right, and as we know, you running, you know, 2:36 on that day, it's just the tip of the iceberg that shows all of the work you put in ahead of time. And I've had the privilege during the past year to really get to know you and to train with you, and watching you prepare for this marathon, and I've certainly been able to see some of the behind the scenes, Tina, that your listeners don't know. So in the spirit of opening up, like, let's just talk a little bit about this buildup towards CIM and some of the high and low points during the last several months. If you're willing to share maybe a workout or two where things weren't going well, and then one where you felt like, okay, I can do this. I've got my goal in sight.
Well, yeah. And just, you know, I mean, I'm sure most people listening know that we all have that person, you know, be it online or be it through, you know, meeting up and running with someone. But this has been so nice for me to have Sarah around to train with, you know, to actually do runs with, even though this last 6 months our training has been on complete opposites.
Hasn't lined up very well.
Sarah is racing a marathon, and then I am in my downtime, and then I'm in my race for a marathon, and she's in her downtime, and it's just been complete opposites. But we've still been able to, you know, do some runs together. And even just being able to say, you know, I really struggled today, or today went really well, and having someone who understood what that meant was really reassuring and helpful. So overall, honestly, the hardest thing with CIM was that things were going very well. And I talked to my sports psychologist, Evie, about this a lot, because I kind of found it hard that in the past I'd always had something go wrong. And I kind of almost prided myself on being the person who overcame something. So I always was that person who, you know, when I was standing on the starting line, I'd be like, I did not go through, you know, that injury, or I did not go through this or that, or whatever it may be.
10 weeks of pool training.
Yeah, and Sarah knows this more than anyone. The reason we first met, or one of the reasons we first met, was at Nationals 1 year, I remember Sarah won the 10K and I finished fifth in the 10K. And even though I finished runner-up 1 year at Nationals, this is Division 2, the time I finished fifth meant more to me than that runner-up, because I had spent all this time in the pool. I wasn't allowed to run a step for a month. And it was only a few months before that I'd had to, you know, just do all my training in the pool. And so getting to that race and finishing All-American was meant more to me than anything else. So I'd always had something go wrong, but this time nothing really went wrong. I mean, I did have an issue with one of my toes, which was a low point, practicing some downhill running, which apparently wasn't enough, but practicing some downhill running, I somehow ended up smashing one of my toes into the end of my shoebox. And it just, my toe swelled up, the nail was just really, really tender, and I just saw my whole race go before my eyes. And this was the week of my half marathon, so I was very nervous about it. So that was very much a low. But then I only really missed one run. So even that wasn't like a big setback. So I just didn't have anything that particularly went wrong. And I actually found that quite hard.
Right, because I remember one time you came out to Moorhead, the town where I live, and you had this workout. And the workout, it went well. It went fine. But we were sitting together in a coffee shop afterwards and discussing it. And even though the workout itself had gone well, you were having trouble wrapping your mind around the idea of saying, okay, well, that's what the pace I'm supposed to run. And now I'm supposed to go do that for 26 miles. It seemed very impossible. Mm-hmm. So for you, when did that pace start to feel possible? Or did it never feel possible and it just kind of happened on race day?
Yeah, I don't think it ever felt possible. And I'm sure most people know this kind of thing of the like psyche and how we mentally see things. But one thing I was struggling with was, you know, being in the 5 minute bracket per mile seemed so much faster than being in the 6 minute per mile. So even though like 5:59 to 6:01 is only 2 seconds, it seemed like it was a monster task. And the kind of pace I was hoping to run was around 5:55 or maybe even a little bit faster. And so the idea of being able to run that for 26 miles just seemed like almost impossible. And yeah, I mean, I could do it for workouts, little chunks, but then it was tough. And yeah, I don't think I ever got to the point to where I actually thought I could do it. But I just, the one thing that really helped me was looking at my previous training and seeing my paces in the previous marathon to see that here's how training had gone and here is what I was able to race. So I think that really helped. But yeah, I don't know if I ever felt confident enough that I was going to do it.
I think the one time I saw you really, really confident, and this is also what I remember as a really big high point of the buildup, was actually, it was just a few days before you left for CIM. And one thing that Tina and I do for each other is during our last several marathons, she always gives me this little gift package where, especially it's for the, your elite bottles. When you have bottles every 10K on the course, you're allowed to decorate them. So Tina always gives me this really sparkly, glittery tape that I can see from a mile away as I'm running towards my bottle. And it reminds me that she's thinking about me and that, you know, she cares about my race. And so this time I went ahead and I got Tina some tape, and then I also got her these tiny little, you want to describe them?
They were like little ring stickers, but the diamond of the ring was like raised, mm-hmm. which was absolutely perfect in the race because it meant when I grabbed the bottle, not only did I see it, I felt it. I could feel it under my fingers, so that really helped.
I do want to clarify that I wasn't getting you diamond rings to be romantic. No, I did it because I know that a really big thing for you is you know, in listening to your husband and the words that he has for you. And so I wanted to remind you every bottle to pay attention to, you know, what your heart was telling you that, mm-hmm. that he would ask you to do during those points of the race. So that was a point when I handed you that tape and those stickers that we discussed it, and you talked about, you know, seeing your bottles, and I saw it in your eyes in just a split second. I was like, she's ready. It just kind of, a switch just flipped. And I thought, I just knew in my mind, I was like, okay, she's going to PR. It's just a matter of by how much. And, so that was the moment I was sure that your race was going to go well, even if you weren't, because it mm-hmm. seems like doubt is always going to be a big thing in those last couple days. Right.
Yeah. And I think, I've kind of realized in this time around that for me, it's not, like I go into it being, you know, maybe the day before, but in the week before, I just tend to have a freak out. Like every day I'm like, you know, saying to Steve, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I want to do this. Why am I doing this? This is not going to be fun. And I remember how much it hurts. I remember how much pain you put yourself through. And you just think, why am I doing this? Like, why can't I just be a normal person who sits and watches Netflix and just chills on the TV? And, you know, the only exercise they get is the 20 minutes that they do on the elliptical. So that whole week I was kind of going through a bit of like ups and downs. And Evie, my sports psychologist I mentioned, she was huge in this, just turning my perspective around, making me feel strong. But then the day before, I have to say, I woke up that morning just feeling complete peace. And I think part of that was I did do a run, like a shakeout run. CIM had this shakeout run, and I don't think I've told you this, Sarah. They did a shakeout run where people of the community could come run with the elites, and we all went together and did this run around the park. And, you know, some people did 20 minutes, some people did 30. I did my 6 miles, as I usually would. Just seeing other people there was just this energy in the air, and there was so much excitement. And then, but it wasn't just that, it was me realizing that, you know, everyone out there is doing it for themselves. So you're not doing it for the pressure. And I kind of realized that everyone wanted me to succeed just as I wanted them to succeed. And it didn't matter who you were or what you were running, but everyone was out there kind of with that nervous energy. And it just really reassured me. And, you know, I got to meet some great people that day, some people who I had known for a while, including Brian or Pavement Runner, which I'm sure a lot of you know, and just some other people that day. It was really cool to just meet, and it just helped me to feel calm and kind of be like, you know what, there's a whole lot more to this whole weekend than just that few hours you're running. There's a whole build-up, all the training you've been through, and it's all part of the journey. So that really helped.
That's for sure. It's funny, but there are times during our hard workouts or our races, we can actually envy people who work those 9-to-5 jobs in an office, because at least they're not putting themselves through physical pain the way that mm-hmm. we do for our profession. And that's tough. But now that you've run 236, it's conceivable that at some point in the near future, You may be at a speaking engagement or something similar, and you will be introduced as, okay, this is 236 marathoner Tina Muir. And it's interesting how, even how I introduced myself for this podcast, I'm 232 marathoner Sarah Crouch. Often as professional runners, we wear our time as a title the way that a doctor or a politician would. And our identity as runners is often caught up in this list of numbers. So how do you separate who you are from what you've run? And along those lines, when a race goes poorly and the numbers don't show what you want them to, how do you keep that from damaging your opinion of yourself as a person?
Wow, this is such a good question and something that, you know, I've never heard anyone else kind of think about before. So it's interesting that you do it. And
sports psychology. Yeah,
yeah, I guess that would be it. I think, yeah, we really do kind of wear it around. And I think it's not even just at the elite level, just in general. I mean, you meet a new runner and within 2 minutes of you both saying that you run, you know, you've run a marathon or you've run a 5K, what's going to come up? What was your time? Mm-hmm. That's, you know, one of the things we tend to talk about. And yeah, I mean, I definitely do kind of make that something that I am proud of. And I think all those hours I've put into working towards it definitely helps that. And then, yeah, I think when you don't run as well as you want, the one moment that sticks out to my mind related to this is just how non-runners actually have absolutely no clue that we wear this as this, like you said, badge of honor or whatever. One of my first memories of running, well, not first memories, but of marathoning was after I ran the Philadelphia Marathon, my first marathon absolutely blew up. I don't know how many of you know this. I know Sarah knows the full story, but I don't even know what happened at mile 19. I couldn't move. I felt like someone had squeezed the air out of my lungs. I love showing people the photo of me at that moment because you would not believe that I managed it another 6 miles or 7 miles feeling like that. My last mile was 8:57, which, keep in mind, like I said, anyone listening, 8:57, you may say, okay, well, that's still pretty fast to me, but my race pace was 6 minutes. So I was 3 minutes slower for that last mile, just about fell across the line. And then I remember I spent the rest of the day crying. And I was in the medical tent for an hour and then eventually got let out and spent the day crying. And I remember the next day I went into LaSalle, the university where I was working, and people would come up to me and they'd say, did you run the marathon yesterday? And I'd be like, yeah, but, and before I could get the but out, they were like, oh, congratulations. And they turned around because that was to them all that really mattered was that you did it. So that really kind of was a moment for me where I was like, wait, most people actually don't really care whether you run good or whether you run bad. That's one thing actually for this marathon. Each of those bottles, in addition to the decorations that Sarah gave me and some, you know, other things they had around to make it stand out, I wrote on there, each of the bottles, people that had helped me, along with one word that I associated with them. So one of my words was fans. So for that, that's like for you guys listening or for anyone who's like supported my journey, I thought about that. And I thought, you know, these people are here because they care about you. They want you to succeed. And that's something I can talk about those bottles a bit more in a minute if you want. But that was a moment where I kind of tried to keep in mind that the people that really matter don't care what you run. They don't care if you run, you know, 20 minutes slower than you want to, or if you ran 20 minutes faster, because to them it's just that you're out there doing it, and that's something to be proud of. So I don't know if that answered the question.
I guess it does. It reminds me of something that my non-running roommate in college said to me. I had had a rough race and I came home and I was just miserable. I was in a terrible mood. And finally, she just throws up her hands, very blunt girl. We got along real well, though. She just threw up her hands and she's like, you know what, Sarah? Don't flatter yourself. Nobody cares. And in that moment, it was so liberating because it suddenly dawned on me. Yeah, when you run poorly, the people who love you, they're going to be disappointed for you. No one's mad at you. Mm-hmm. No one's disappointed mm-hmm. in you. You know, they want you to be happy and mm-hmm. to run well. But if you don't, it's not going to damage their opinion of you. And I'm also reminded of this scene from this horrible Adam Sandler movie named Anger Management, where the Adam Sandler character is in group therapy and the therapist was like, you know, tell us who you are, Dave. And he's like, oh, well, I'm Dave. I'm an executive at a pet company. And he's like, no, Dave, don't tell us what you do. Tell us who you are. And Dave's like, okay, I'm a pretty good guy. I play tennis on occasion. He's like, you know, Dave, not your hobbies. Tell us who you are. And this goes on and on until Dave blows up and he's like, I don't know what you want me to say. So I'm not trying to do that to you, but for a moment, can you try and amputate running for a second from your personality and share who you are outside of that for the listeners that don't, maybe don't know very much about you as a person?
And here come the tears. No, I'm just kidding. Okay, what am I? I feel like you're going to, everything I'm going to say. So outside of running, well, one thing I will say, and you can say back to this, you can do this with all of this because you know me well enough, but one thing I really like to do is make people feel good about themselves. Mm-hmm. So I like to think that I am a good, caring person who would put others' needs in front of my own if it need to. I always use the example of, like, if my friend was stuck in Mexico and they called me crying and said, you know, come get me, I would jump straight in my car and go get them. So I like to think I'm a good person who puts others first, definitely a perfectionist. With that, I hold myself to way too high standards, which I know you wanted to kind of talk about things people wouldn't know about me. And I really struggle with sleep. And I think a lot of that is because this sounds ridiculous. And I was actually talking to Matt Fitzgerald, who I know many of you are big fans of, about how I wake up in the morning and my mind like switches on as if someone has flipped a switch. And I can't wait to get out of bed because there's so many things that I want to do. And some of them it isn't so much I want to do, but I feel like I need to do. Like, I need to pay the bills. I need to get going with this. I need to remember to reply to this person or that person. So I definitely put a lot of pressure on myself. And then I guess the other thing I would say is I, you know, obviously care deeply for people, but I like to think I'm honest. I will tell people, I'm not going to straight out tell someone something nasty, but I try and like share my true feelings, even if it means making myself look a bit stupid, because I feel like it will help people feel better about themselves. So yeah, I don't know.
You know, it's funny. I'm actually going to go ahead and skip ahead a little bit in my notes, and I'm going to share the list of things because I thought to myself, okay, what are some things about Tina that I've learned in the past year? As Tina and I, we lived together for like 5 months. Mm-hmm. What are some things that I've learned that maybe your listeners don't know? And it's funny, but you hit almost on the nose the things that I wrote down, so I'll just go ahead and read those. First one that I wrote down, yeah, you're up before dawn every single day. I want to say 5:30 or 6. It would be weird if you weren't up at 5:30 or 6. The second thing I wrote, you are a type A perfectionist and you are extremely hardworking. I'd say you're probably one of the hardest working individuals I've ever met. The three things that I think you're most passionate about are your family, food, and running. Probably in that order. I maybe rig running above food, but Tina's a wonderful cook for those that don't know. A fourth thing, I'm going to embarrass you a little bit. Tina has a gorgeous singing voice and an obsession carried over from the 80s with what boy band?
I think most people probably know this, but Backstreet Boys.
Yeah.
Can I tell the story?
Yes.
Are you gonna ask?
Yeah, that's okay.
Okay, so some of you probably know this, but a few months ago, so I love them. We both do. We have had times where we've driven around singing for like singing Backstreet Boys because we both love them. But a few months ago, as luck would have it, I was in Lexington Airport and Brian Littrell, who one of the Backstreet Boys, the main singer.
Our favorite.
Well, I don't know. I think Nick was probably my favorite.
Okay, we can talk about that later.
Although I feel like if I've met Brian, it should be him. He walked past me and I looked at him and he turned around and he went, shh, because he knew, I knew who he was, but I couldn't leave him. So I like
she
ran
after him. She fangirled for those that know the expression.
I did. I ran after him and he came back and he shook Steve's hand and he talked with us and I took a picture, which is the most dorky picture ever and doesn't even look like me. But yes. I do not have a good singing voice, though.
I completely
I turn the music so loud that no one can hear my singing voice.
I'm not going to make you prove it here on the air, but the last thing I wrote down is, again, I said, you are one of the most loyal people I know, generous, caring, thoughtful, and you're always willing to give your friends anything that they need. So I think you have your own personality nailed pretty spot on, at least from what I can see. So, all right. So another question that I was curious about, and this actually involves the podcast itself, but over time, how has the loss of your, for lack of a better word, your anonymity among the running community, how has that affected you in running in life? Because you become well known both in your blog, in your running, and then in the podcast. I even know some of the athletes that I coach, I had an athlete that I took on last month. She's like, oh, you must be Tina's Sarah. And I was like, yes, I'm Tina's Sarah. So I often am approached by people who know you, and I'm sure that happens to you quite a bit now. So how has that loss of anonymity, how has that affected you in your running and in your life?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I've actually thought about quite a lot lately, because it's something that has finally got to the point to where I'm actually starting to notice it. And actually, it's funny, Sarah and I, just at lunch, we were just talking about with our friend Morgan, who is probably listening, so hi, Morgan. We were talking about how I've had a few emails that have been kind of a bit aggressive about the podcast, saying, you know, I didn't like this, I didn't like that. And, you know, that's kind of the sign that, you know, you're reaching a wide audience if you are getting those emails. And I really, one thing I've really found it hard to do, and you'll probably even notice a difference between listening to this and Sarah and I talking and me and someone else, because I feel so much more relaxed right now. And the hardest thing I've found is I'm very sensitive. So if someone says something that is not maybe mean, but just something that upsets me, it really gets to me. So I found it really difficult sometimes lately to kind of keep, kind of, I want to put off a good vibe and I want to, you know, show positivity, but it's sometimes things people say, I let them get to me more than I probably should. And I've probably just opened myself up now to get like more like, I hate you.
Well, yeah, I'm going to make you cry. That brings up a good point though with positivity, because now I consider you someone who is a role model for women and young women. How do you maintain that positivity while being honest with your audience mm-hmm. about the struggles that you go through?
Yeah. So I have to say that a few, maybe even a month ago, a lot of people kept messaging me saying, you're going to smash this marathon. You're going to crush it. I'm so excited for you. You're going to do so well. And I knew everyone was meaning it in a good way. And of course I knew that meant people supported me, but for a little while I really struggled, because I thought, you know, everyone's saying I'm going to do so well. What if I don't? Mm-hmm. What if I don't? Like, what if everyone, this is one of those situations where you kind of almost expect it to happen and then it doesn't. And it was only, like I said, with the bottles, when I was able to spin it and kind of say, you know, all those people out in the crowds are the people that have emailed you. They are literally cheering your name, saying, go Tina, go Tina. So I managed to turn it around. But yeah, it can be difficult, especially with some of the things, you know, sometimes you even feel like a bit of a phony talking about yourself. I mean, you know, sometimes people will ask me, you know, give me your advice on the marathon or something you've done in the marathon. And I'm thinking like, well, haven't you, like before this one, I'd only done four. Like, I'm not sure I'm a better person to ask than, you know, this person who's done 12, 15, 20 marathons. They know better than me. And so sometimes I would find it hard, because, you know, there was me telling people what to do and people literally following my advice. And then sometimes I felt like I was kind of a bit of a hypocrite, like, or, okay, here's another good example, like stretching or flexibility. You know, I've said how much it helps and I've said how good it is for you, although I'm not as good at it as I should be. I do stretch, but I tend to do the same like three stretches every time and then, you know, go off and do something else, get back to work or whatever. And so sometimes it is difficult to kind of separate it and tell people, you should be doing this. This is what I'm doing, even though I'm not always doing it to the level I should be. So sometimes it is hard, but I just try and remind myself that the more honest I am with people, and I do try to be honest, I hope that comes across, that, you know, when I'm having a bad day, I don't see it as a weakness saying I'm having a bad day. Instead, I see it as like, okay, this is me being brave and me telling people that, you know, even someone who you look up to and think, you know, is having a great time every day, I'm not, and I'm really struggling. And you've done the same thing too. You wrote that blog post earlier this year where you kind of said that you had a hard time, and I think that shows a lot of courage in a lot of ways. So just kind of staying true to who you are.
For sure. Yeah, it's no, there's definitely something to that, especially when you know that younger girls and girls who are just entering college and things like that mm-hmm. are looking to you and the choices that you make. Mm-hmm. And it does make me wonder, let's say that you had never picked up this podcast, you'd never started a blog, you had no internet, you lived in a cabin and you ran, would your performances today be the same as they would given the personality and how your media life has shaped that? Do you believe that you would be as fast or faster or maybe not as fast?
to be totally honest, I think I might be a little bit faster because I think a lot of times I get distracted by things. And I know you've seen little glimmers of it. Steve has definitely commented on it where I will, you know, I'll spend all night worrying about a podcast that's coming out the next morning because I want it to come out right. And, you know, I'm worried about what the response is going to be or something like that. So I think it kind of has a diverted my attention in some instances, or, you know, like I mentioned earlier, that sometimes it's like the pressure, or like I might feel like people are going to be like, oh, haha, she had it coming, or, you know, she was getting a bit too big for her boots anyway. So I feel like in a lot of ways it would help me. But then on the other side of things, I don't do well with just running. I did do that one summer, and, you know, maybe one summer wasn't long enough to give it a chance. But like Steve always mentions, I seem to find stress if I don't have any. So I feel like I would find something else to stress about, even if I didn't have that.
No, I'm sure. And I know, obviously, the podcast has, you know, its ups and downs in terms of stresses and this and that. But on the bright side, you get to talk to a lot of interesting people. And I'm sure your listeners would want to know, so far, what has been your favorite interview on the podcast?
I think most people actually probably do know this because I have mentioned it a lot. Dick Beardsley was probably my favourite. Mm. But I will say, actually, I think Jared Ward might have taken over. So that one comes out next week. And I do apologise to anyone listening. You guys who are listening, if you're listening to this, you obviously are interested in me and my training. But this one with Jared, I just, everything he said, I was like, me too! Me too! So I was just having a bit of a fangirl moment with him. So Jared might be the new takeover. So
that's
that
exciting.
One comes live next week.
Yeah, that's very exciting. Jared is someone who, at 27 years old, made the Olympic team as the youngest member by about 3 years, I think. And, mm-hmm. and for someone like that to have such a major moment where they, you know, they finally make it. Was there like a moment in your running career where you finally were like, okay, I've made it. I'm mm-hmm. where I want to be.
Yeah, it was this year. I mean, I know you know that. Mm-hmm. So my lifelong goal had always been to run for Great Britain in a world championship. I had, you know, used that in moments where I didn't want to go out for my run, or where I didn't want to run, or even, you know, if I was in a workout and I was kind of feeling sorry for myself and I was like kind of tempted to slack off the pace, I would be like, no, Great Britain, Great Britain. And I would say that. And I just had this thing of one day I wanted to hold the jersey in my hands, knowing I had earned it. So then this year when Great Britain selected me for the World Half Marathon team, that was just that moment. But the craziest part was, I know you know this, I was incredibly stressed in the maybe month, 6 weeks before, because I didn't know if they were going to take me or not. And it was very hit and miss. They didn't let the team know until 3 weeks before.
For those that aren't aware of it, the selection process is arbitrary, to say the least. It's very, very, you have no idea what's going on until.
Yeah. So, yes, it's literally last minute, and even crazier than that. So I got that phone call 3 weeks before, and they said, we're not taking you. And I just felt like my world came crumbling down. I think you were upstairs sleeping, weren't you? When I got the phone call, and you came down, and I was just wailing. Like,
oh,
I was just crying my eyes out, and I couldn't even get the words out. Like, I remember it was one of those situations where you're kind of like spitting because you can't speak, and it's just your nose is running. And I was like doing this, and Sarah came downstairs, and I couldn't even tell her what happened, but she's just hugging me and telling me it was going to be okay. And so then I didn't think I made it, but then I just had this feeling in the bottom of my heart, in my soul, that I was still going to do it. Somehow I was going to do it.
It's funny, I did too. And I know I'm a relentless optimist. And I was like, oh, well, they're going to take you because they have to take you.
Yeah.
And eventually they did.
And then, sure enough, a few days before, literally the day I was leaving to go to England to run for England instead of Great Britain, because they allowed an English team to run as well, I got the phone call saying I'd been moved up to Great Britain and finished third out of five for the Great Britain team. And then for that, they took me to the European Championships. So I got to do it twice. But that first time, when I rounded the corner of that first, the World Half Marathon, and I mean, I think most people have probably seen the photo of me if you've been listening or paying attention for a while. I just, that moment for me was like, I've done it. And I did worry a little bit afterwards that it would kind of be one of those situations where I would lose motivation and I wouldn't want to keep training because I've done the number one thing I wanted to do. But thankfully,
that's so much better than my moment. It was several years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I got a friend request from Dina Casper, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm in. So a little bit different.
And she added you as well, not just, yeah. She accepted you.
And so I was like, is this the real Dina Casper? And it was.
Called the real Dina Casper?
No, it was just her name. It's just so silly. But at that moment, I think I called my mom. I was like, guess what? No, it's just silly how you have little moments throughout your career that mean something, that push you to a different level. But it can be anything. But yeah, that's a good one. I'd like to go ahead and move on. We have actually some questions from your listeners. We have quite a few, so we'll get started with those. Paul asks, he says, I would love for Sarah to ask you about your teenage running exploits, so please share.
Well, I've told most people who have listened to an interview with me before know that I actually hid in the bathrooms for the cross country tryouts because I had no interest in doing it.
So I didn't know that.
You didn't?
No.
Well, yeah, I did. So I actually at the beginning had no interest whatsoever in running, and it was just kind of, I hate to say this, but like talent kind of worked its way up. I didn't really like try much harder, but I just found myself in the first few people in my class, which kind of bumped me onto the cross country team eventually, and then just started progressing from there. And I remember the girl on my school team who was the number one girl on the team and seeing her up ahead and thinking, I want to get her, I want to beat her, and then I'm going to beat everyone else. Because I think she was finishing like fourth or fifth, so she was quite near the front. So that kind of switched it on. But I guess the biggest moment then for me was I went to join a running club, because in England that's how everything is done with running. And I met my coach, Brad Plummer, who was amazing and just... thankfully, he didn't push me too hard. There's so many people, probably more in England than I'd say over here. Teenagers get pushed like so hard that they just are completely broken by the time they're 18.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because there isn't the college system, whereas here the college system is kind of the reward. Mm. So people get pushed when they're college athletes, and then by then you're kind of almost old enough to be able to maybe handle it. I mean, obviously, a lot of people get through college and they're like burned out by then. But I'm talking like, I remember I started running like the serious races around 14, and I was considered a latecomer. So I think a lot of people get pushed around 11, 12. And then, especially the women, you know, or the girls, I should say, they improve a lot. But then, you know, the change happens, the hips come through, and then they struggle. And so, yeah, I'm just thankful I wasn't pushed too hard, because a lot of the girls who I raced against when I was younger, not even running at all anymore. So that kind of makes me sad.
Yeah.
Teenage running years, people who know me more intimately, I know you do know this, but around age 17, I kind of fell off the rails a little bit, went into the partying lifestyle. Believe it or not, people find that hard to believe now when they know me now, but... definitely was going out a lot, like 2-3 nights a week, drinking a lot, partying a lot. And then, funny thing, I don't think I've told you this, as I tried to pull myself out of this lifestyle, I thought, well, I'll stop drinking.
She's drunk right now.
Yeah. Always drunk. I thought, I'll stop drinking, but instead I'm going to drink Red Bull. So I would drink Red Bull on nights out. Like
the logic of
Red
a 17-year-old, my God.
And so what of course happened then, I like didn't sleep. And so just would kind of running on, burning all cylinders, trying to like survive.
Oh,
and then sometimes I'd try and race on the weekends, which obviously did not go very well. But yeah, so then I fell off the rails, just considered giving it up. And I specifically remember one turning moment in my life was my mum pulled me aside and she said to me, Tina, and my mum is the nicest, sweetest little, like, cute lady there is. She was like, are you sure you want to do this anymore? And I just, like, flew off the handle, like, how dare you say that? And, you know, but she was right. Why would she not, it didn't look like I wanted to do it. And in all reality, I was probably doing it to keep my weight off so I could keep partying. But I just remember that being a moment where it took me probably a few weeks.
Red Bull rehab.
Started smoking cigarettes. Just kidding. But yeah, eventually that made me realize that I wanted to turn things around. And it was my grandma telling me that I got really big. She was a German woman, so she was not afraid to be direct. That really like made me decide that I wanted to give my running a real try. And so I put my head down, and it took me probably 2 years to dig myself out of that hole.
It's so funny because that is so opposite of the Tina that I know and train with. And actually, it's funny, but the next question is from Kiara, and she asks, I would love to hear about you girls training together and pushing each other and being a positive influence for each other.
So I want you to tell them about that day that we did that workout together.
I know exactly the workout you're talking about.
Yeah.
Tina and I had 3x3 miles and you had 2x3 miles?
I think I had 3, you had 4.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Gosh, that was a long workout. So we headed up to Cincinnati where there's this long, flat bike path, and we had 3x3 miles. I'm horrible with numbers. I don't even remember the paces really we were running, maybe 540s or something like that.
Starting slower.
And so Tina and I had, we trained a little bit together at that point, but not a whole lot. I think that was our first real workout mm-hmm. together. And it was just like when you place that last piece of the puzzle in and it just satisfying and it just clicks.
Mm-hmm.
And we established this very comfortable routine where you like to lead, I like to follow. I tucked right in behind you, and we somehow got through this workout, and it was so effortless. And the funny thing was, when you stopped and I had another 3 mile piece to go, I did my last 3 mile piece and I was like, oh, this is gonna be great, I feel so good. And I fell apart without you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in that moment that I just realized how powerful training with another person
mm-hmm.
of your skill set and your abilities can be. And since then, we've had maybe 4 or 5, a handful of good workouts together where we're able to push each other in such a way that is both, this sounds odd to say, but it's both competitive and non-competitive
mm-hmm.
at the same time.
Does that make sense? No, I agree. Definitely.
Yeah. And I think it's important to have both. And I think that in our culture where as millennials we're taught, oh, everyone's a winner, it's important
mm-hmm.
to actually say, you know what? No, I'm going to push you to be better and you're going to push me to be better.
Mm-hmm.
And even if that's not comfortable, we're going to do that. So
mm-hmm.
that to me has been one of the most, and even though we don't train together all the time, because we live an hour apart, it's been one of the most rewarding training relationships I've ever had.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, like Sarah said, it has been, is huge. And having that person, and by the competitive and non-competitive thing she means, I mean, obviously, when you take two runners together, or, you know, anyone who's competitive doing anything, you want to be as best you can be. And of course, that internal instinct is going to come out. But I think both of us can kind of say that we've both trained mostly on our own our whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
But this has really been the first time for me that I've, and I know you as well, have had someone there to run with and train with that you want to succeed as much as you do yourself. Like, you know, the morning of Sarah's marathons or her with mine, I am just as nervous as she is. I am like the night before, like stressing out because I just want her to do well. And, you know, you want to cry, like if something goes wrong, because you just know what they've put in and what they've done for it. And, you know, and so it's just something so special when you have those workouts as well. And you get to like, you know, especially for Sarah and I, like she mentioned, I like to, you know, most of you know, I like to pace. I like to be my metronome who can run my splits. And Sarah likes to, you know, have that person there, which, you know, essentially you like to, if you could have a pacer who would pace you through your entire race, you'd do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to, I mean, maybe someday I should be a pacer, but I like to pace. I like to set the tone and just kind of run it. And so it just works so like effortlessly for both of us. So yeah, I think it's been just such a blessing. And yeah.
I wish you could have seen me the morning of CIM, because there was no live feed. So what I had was these updates that would show up every 5 to 6 miles. And so for that last portion, I got your update at 20 miles. And then I knew I wasn't going to know how you did until you finished. And I was literally just holding my phone, just pacing back and forth, swearing, yelling at the phone.
Doing?
He was just sitting there calmly watching me go, as he usually does. And when it finally came through, man, because I was watching the clock tick by, and I was like, okay, maybe the tracking system, maybe it's off, and I don't know, and it's, you know, and running through all these scenarios. So I definitely feel that we are connected in that way. And something very cool that happened this year was we ran spring marathons. I ran Boston, and a week later you ran London.
Yeah, yeah.
And our seconds were, or our times were 1 second apart.
Mm-hmm.
Which is absolutely nuts. For those
mm-hmm.
of you who run a marathon, you know how rare that is. But speaking of marathons racing, Ellie asks, what is next for you?
Well, we are trying to figure that one out right now. Probably by the time this goes live, we might have figured it out. But my three options are, and I don't even know if I've fully discussed this with you, my number one option would be the Gold Coast Marathon in July. The reason that is my friend Brad Beer, who many of you know from his episodes on the podcast, he is trying to work with them to get me to come over there to do the race, maybe even do like a podcast, like Race to the Gold Coast, because basically the Gold Coast Marathon is where the Commonwealth Games will be in 2018. And that is my next big goal, to run for England in the Commonwealth Games. So if I could run that a year before, after learning what I did about CIM to know the course, that's the number one. But that is going to be very dependent on them and what they have available.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard that Gold Coast was ranked one of the most beautiful marathons in the world.
Oh, I don't know that. I know it's fast.
Yes, it's supposed to be very beautiful.
It's supposed to be perfect. I've heard that. So that would be good. My number two option is going to make a lot of people happy. It's potentially Boston.
I recommend it, yes.
Yeah, you did it this year. So, and then number three is also, I would say, is equally as likely as Boston, is to just do a full half marathon build up, just focusing on the half marathon, and then going for some more speed stuff in the summer, like 5K, 10K. So those are my three options, not set up completely yet. But if you would like to pester Gold Coast Marathon, feel free, because if we can get them to do that, that's my primary.
Absolutely. And I was going to ask you about time goals, but actually the next question we have kind of speaks to that. It says, you've talked about your A and B and C goals. And even though you mentioned the time that you ran at CIM 236, it was a PR, that also only hit your C goal, which of A, B, and C, C being the slowest. So how do you go about goal setting? And how do you know whether or not a goal is ambitious enough? Or too ambitious, I guess.
I think a lot of it for me comes on Steve. I pester the heck out of him until he gives me numbers, because I'm a run by feel person, but Steve takes it to a whole new level. Like, he doesn't even like to tell me a pace, he doesn't like to tell me a goal, he doesn't like to say any of those numbers, he just likes to let it happen. So I usually just bug him until he gives me a number, or I'll keep going about it in a different way of saying, well, do you think I can run this? And then eventually I'll get a response to where I think that means yes. Mm-hmm. And then I know that's the goal. But 2:30, sub 2:34 was my A goal. That was, we think looking at it, we were probably, that might have been a long shot. Definitely with that course. But I think a course maybe like Chicago or even London, I think I would have been able to get that. So we tried to do it as, the A goal, we actually have four in essence. We have a stars aligned, which is, you know, that best race of your life that everything clicks in. You might get two or three of those in your life. Mm. That was a 2:32 high. But then we thought sub 2:34 was my like A goal. But we knew I was going to have a good day. Everything was going to have to go well. The training had gone very well, so it was kind of indicating that. And then the B goal just seemed like a natural place, which was sub 2:35, in between the C and the B, that I would be very happy with. So,
And it's interesting, but your goals, it can be easy late in a race if you feel like your A goal and then your B goal and maybe your C goal, if things start to feel out of reach, how do you stay mentally tough at the end of a race, especially if you know at that point that your A goal is not going to happen?
Well, interestingly, with the goals, I didn't know. The last time I looked at my watch was at the 10K. And I was 30 seconds faster than Steve said was too fast. So,
you did not look at your watch one time after 10K?
No.
It's crazy.
And I went past the halfway, like, don't you look, don't you dare look, don't you dare look. And I like made myself look at the floor, so I didn't even like get like out of the corner of my eye the number. And then, yeah, I didn't know anything. I got tempted the last few miles, but I didn't want to be in a situation where I look down on my watch and it said 2:30 something and I still had, you know, a mile to go. So I was like, well, 2 miles to go, I guess, will be there. So I just didn't look. But yeah, I didn't know anything. CIM, you turn a corner with literally 50 meters to go. So that hurt. But once I turned that corner and I saw 2:36, that was when I knew. So it wasn't so much the goals, but I could...
What did you feel when you turned that corner and you saw that and you knew you were going to PR? Was it relief? Like, what were the emotions that went through your mind?
I think it was anger, honestly, because... at that point, I was still replaying. A girl, Sam Blusky, had overtaken me with like a mile to go. And I didn't even see her coming. I didn't see her until she... It was one of those situations you see, you know, in a final of a track race where the person doesn't even realize they're coming until they're already gone. It was kind of one of those, although obviously a lot slower than a sprint.
It just happens in slow motion.
Yeah, that's what we call it. But I remember hearing someone say about half a mile before that, a man saying, "I don't see another girl in sight." And I don't want to say I let off the pedal, but I definitely, if I knew she was coming, I think I would have been able to keep fighting ahead, but I didn't. I kind of got in this place of like, well, that's good enough. And so I think I was angry at myself for not kind of, you know, giving my very best. If I ask myself, did I give my best? I would say yes. But the fact that when she passed me, I was like, oh, I shouldn't have listened to that man. That makes me think that I didn't. But then when it came to mentally tough, I mean, I'm a big fan of mantras. So I was using those a lot, those last 4 miles, just kind of saying words. Be your own hero was my major one for this event. But I also was saying, Drew made me strong. Drew is my strength coach. So I just kept saying, Drew made me strong, Drew made me strong. Because we worked on that exact thing, that when it came to the end of a race, I would have the, from the strength training, I would have that power to be able to keep working forward and keep pushing. And then the other thing I kept saying was just each mile, I focused on just being at that moment and saying, am I doing my best? Yes, I'm doing my best. Okay, that's all you can do. So I was just encouraging myself, asking, was I doing my best? And then if the answer was yes, then I was just saying, then that's all you can do. So just being very reassuring rather than, I used to always be, it was kind of almost like, I don't know if you've ever had this, Sarah, but like, I always used to be in a race and it would be like, I can't do this, like internally in my head, I can't do this. Yes, you can do this. But I can't. It's too hard. I just want to stop. Yes, you can. You've got to keep going. And it was like this argument in my head. But now it's kind of like, I can't do this. And it's like, yes, you can. You're fine. You're doing great. Come on.
You like mother yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think maybe that is because I'm a like mothering person that works with me. But yeah. So being nice to myself has helped a lot rather than being aggressive. And what would you say you're the same? Or are you more... I think you get angry more, don't you?
Yeah, I was going to say, I have those voices and then 5 or 6 other voices just like screaming obscenities from the sidelines. I will say, though, you describing the last 50 meters of that race, it reminded me of something. It actually reminded me of watching, I was a teenager, watching my mom's first marathon.
Mm-hmm.
She led the Portland Marathon until the last 50 meters, and she was in her mid-40s, got passed by a 20-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the look on her face, and it was an absolute despair because there was just nothing she could do. And but then she, you know, crossed the line and she just laid there and she was devastated and proud at the same moment,
yep.
Which I think is exactly how you felt.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say, you know, it's like, I think I'm very much a believer in the fact that in that moment, you give what you have in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that you did, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think you should be proud of that.
Yeah.
The next question we have is actually about your pre-race meal. And then we'll actually go ahead and talk about your post-race food as well, which I know is a lot more fun than pre-race. So go ahead and talk about what you generally eat the day before a marathon.
The day before is a little tough because for me, most people know that I eat a lot of, well, you definitely know this, I eat a lot of like vegetables, I eat a lot of like starchy foods, but not so much like the typical, you know, pasta, bread, rice, things like that. So I don't eat that many of those in daily life. But obviously, I know with a marathon, you have to carb load. And I think actually earlier this year, I did go a little bit too far with eating too much fat and protein and not enough carbs. I know I was getting the caloric intake okay, but I was definitely not getting enough carbs. And I think that's why I struggled for a little while. So I learned from that. So I did have... We went out for dinner. Oh no, we went out for lunch, and I went to this Hawaiian restaurant, which was really cool. And Steve and I had been a few days before, and I had a really good meal there. But I went in and I said, "Can I have the chicken rice bowl, please?" And they said, "Okay, what would you like on it?" It was like blackened Cajun. They had all these different spices. I was like, "Plain," and they were like, "Okay." And then I was like, "And can I have extra rice instead of this like amazing coleslaw they had?" And they were like, okay, what would you like on the rice? And I was like, plain. Like, it just was like embarrassing boring almost. Meal. Yeah, it was. And so I had that, and then I just ate. I had 3 potatoes for dinner, like big baked potatoes. Didn't even eat the skin, but just literally 3 potatoes. So the most boring day of eating ever, but it got the job done, I guess. For my sure. stomach was fine. And Yucan during was very helpful too. Obviously.
So what about, what is the first thing you're craving after a race? What is your go-to? I think I know the answer to this, but.
It's usually, well, something sugary. I think most people know that, but I'd say a burger is my post-race meal. This time around, for some reason though, I actually have been telling Sarah about it. There's these things called cranberry bliss bars at Starbucks. And for some reason we walked past the sign walking back to the hotel, and my friend Carly and her husband Nate and Steve and I were walking, and Steve and I at the exact same moment pointed at this sign that said cranberry bliss bars, because he knew I would want it and I wanted it. So that was my first thing. But I think actually the first thing I ate was, I picked up a muffin and I just ate the top, just the sugar in it. But yeah, and then I had we found a place called the Waffle Experience, which was a burger with like bacon and aioli and all the good stuff. And then it was 2 waffles as the bun, which was amazing. Mm-hmm. And then I went and got my cake. Oh, I've always got to have my sweet. And
did you have ice cream that day?
Yes.
Okay, because that I would say that most days after marathons, yeah, so you I generally do, yeah. have ice cream. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so last time before London, I had that freak shake, which I can put a link in the show notes to the picture, but I know you've seen it and you
yeah.
love it.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to go there if you ever go to London, get one of those. But yeah, this time around I had peanut butter chocolate cake with cake batter ice cream. So, although I can't remember if I even told you this, but I reached my sugar limit. I never thought I'd hit that ceiling, but I did, to the point to where the last few mouthfuls of cake were just, yeah, kind of that feeling of where you're like too full.
Yeah.
But it wasn't from being full. It was just, it was making me feel sick from the sugar. So.
Yeah. It's funny. And this is probably going to gross a lot of you out, but after my marathons, and I've done 6 or 7 now, but the very first place I go is Taco Bell.
Brave.
It is, and it's just like the thing, they have this silly little thing on the menu, and it's like a buck, it's like a loaded baked potato grilled tortilla thing, and I get like 4 of them. It's so good. That to me is like, there's nothing better I could eat after marathon. Everyone has their thing, okay?
Yeah.
I'm not gonna
yeah.
apologize for it. All right, so this is something I've been looking forward to for the last hour. I put together a little rapid fire round where I'm gonna ask Tina a question. She responds in 1 word. I've got 8 questions, and they get progressively more interesting. Okay, are you ready?
Yep.
All right, first question. If you could be a professional in any other sport, what sport would it be?
Tennis.
Tennis. I could see that. Cute clothes for tennis.
Mm-hmm.
All right, 2. Race a marathon in 100-degree heat or 0-degree cold?
I can't believe I'm saying this, but 0 degrees.
I would feel the same way.
Yeah, I hate the cold, but I think I would still pick that.
I agree. Okay, 3, win a major race in a slow time or finish dead last with a PR?
Dead last with a PR.
Oh, I like that. What about winning the Olympics in a slow time or finishing dead last in a PR?
How much of a PR are we talking here?
Sub-2:34 or winning the Olympics with a 2:45? Which, by the way, would never happen. Okay, no, I like that too, and I think I'd go for the same answer. Okay, 4, do you more often follow your head or your heart?
Can I say none of the above and say my gut? Like,
yes.
What would you classify?
I'd say that's your heart, mostly.
My
but I'd say you have a good mix of both. I'd say
you're
maybe 30%
head. I feel like my heart cries quite a lot, though. My gut is a bit more of a, on a level
ground.
Just your
instinct. I like that. Okay, so 1 word that you would use to describe yourself as a runner.
Pacer.
So pacing. Like steady kind of?
Steady, yeah, there you go.
I would say metronome, that's how I would describe
metronome,
you.
Metronome, yeah.
That's funny. Okay, 1 word you would use to describe yourself as a person.
The first word that came to my head was motherly.
Motherly? Tina has no kids yet. But yeah, you mother me, so I like it. All right, 7. Answer this sentence. 1 thing I can't live without is blank.
Sugar.
Sugar. I expected it to be my husband. Sugar is the answer that we get, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, and this is my favorite, and I'm so sorry to do this to you. Would you rather have 20 tarantulas hiding somewhere in your house or 2,000 mosquitoes flying around your bedroom?
I'd say the tarantulas.
What? No, I'd go with the mosquitoes every single time. Yeah, they're hiding somewhere in your house.
My mosquito bites, like, swell up.
So. Okay, but open your freezer and there's a tarantula. That's not okay.
And if it's in the freezer, it's probably dead.
That's fair. All right, so... An Arctic tarantula. Yeah. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and round off the podcast here with the questions that Tina always asks her guests. So the first one is, what is the best advice that you have ever received?
Actually, it's the greatest advice. You got to get the question.
Oh, gosh,
right.
I wrote that wrong.
Just kidding. And I was just saying to Sarah when I told her she had to include these that I actually hadn't thought about this at all. So I'm going to go with my favorite quote. So he's my advice, which is Rocky Balboa saying, "It ain't about how hard you hit." I can keep going if you want the rest of the quote.
Yeah, keep going.
All right. I haven't got
the Rocky Balboa. Do it in the Sylvester Stallone
voice. I don't have it. So it's going to be my accent, so it doesn't sound very good. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done.
Bravo.
Although there's a little bit more, but I'll learn that bit.
That's awesome. Okay, second one, your favorite book / blog. If you don't say mine, I'm walking out of here.
Yeah, Sarah's blog, for sure. I really like, I'd probably say Phoebe Wright is my favorite blog. I love how real she is.
I agree.
And we do have an episode with her. I'll put the link in the show notes for that.
What about book?
Book. Matt Fitzgerald, How Bad Do You Want It?
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you could give advice, let's make this a little more interesting, not just advice to a new runner. If you could go back and talk to 15-year-old Tina, what would you say?
See, I wouldn't say to not go off the rails and go partying, because I honestly think in the long run that made me a better person and a better runner. So I would say to believe in yourself and trust that the journey will unfold the way it was supposed to.
I like that. Because it always does. Mm-hmm. It always does.
Exactly.
Okay, and the last one is favorite product. And I know you use a lot of different products for a lot of different things, but if you had to live with just one, your desert island product here.
It would have to be my running shoes, I think, because otherwise I'd be kind of in trouble without them. But the tough part would be picking a pair. So I would probably say the Saucony Ride, my go-to shoe.
I like that a lot. Is there anything else that you would like to add to your listeners in this setting where you're not necessarily a host? Any secrets you want to share with thousands of people?
Any secrets I want to share? I mean, you've got most of the big ones. No, I don't really have anything else, I guess. If you do enjoy this kind of an episode or you do want to learn more about me, my blog is tinamuir.com. I'll put a link in the show notes, which will be, I hadn't even thought about this, but let's say runnersconnect.net/Tina and Sarah with an H. Sarah with an H. So I would go just look at my blog if you want to know more. And then maybe you could say your stuff, because I'm sure people have like learned more about you and they want to kind of follow
along
with you.
I am on Instagram as Sarah Crouch 1989. I am on, I don't know my Twitter handle. I never use it, let's be honest. my blog, if you just Google Sarah's Running Shorts, it's supposed to be clever, short stories about running. It's pretty good.
It is. And her blog is good to read, for sure.
Thank you. I don't post very often, but when I do, I think a lot about my posts. But anyways, we hope you've enjoyed this special Christmas podcast. And if there is anything else that Tina and I have left out, we are also both reachable through Runners Connect.
And we'll do another one of these, I think, maybe in the new year with Sarah, so you can learn more about her as well.
Absolutely. So signing off, this is Sarah and Tina.
Thank you, guys.